It is Saturday, September 25th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California today on GeekSpeak, Geek News, and your questions and comments about technology. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com. It's time now for GeekSpeak. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Thank you, Michael, for submitting your theme to us and giving it to everybody for free. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor, which means you can share this show with anyone you like in any way you'd like, and you don't even have to ask us. If you want to help make content for GeekSpeak, we're always looking for new themes and imagery for the website, please let us know at geekspeak.org. In fact, just email us, geeks at geekspeak.org. And speaking of geeks, in the air with me are Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Mr. Elam.
Good morning.
We also have Al Luckow. Al Luckow is a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
And Mr. Benjamin Jaffe, a freelance media guy.
Hey there.
I never call you Benjamin.
Did you call me Benjamin?
I called you Benjamin.
I prefer Benji.
He's cuter when you call him Benji.
I want to start calling him Button, like Benjamin Button.
Or cute as a button. Benny Do.
Benny Do?
Like my siblings all,
hear,
they're like,
don't want to hear cover. Or
Emmy Do, Benny Do.
Really?
Adam Goo.
We're done with this subject. Miles, what is going on with the Kindle in the world today?
Clearwater High School in Florida has started a pilot program where their students are getting the Kindle e-reader instead of textbooks.
Wow. So no textbooks.
Just the Kindle. So instead of a big, huge, you know, backpack that makes basically feels like you're carrying a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
And you just have this one device.
Okay, so right off the bat, for some reason, I think, okay, is the administration of the school being able to spy on how much reading they do and all these things that accompany digital technologies? Like, can the teacher go, did you read your homework last night, Benny? Oh, you didn't, because I see it online that you didn't.
I don't know that the Kindle actually has that.
I don't know either.
Functionality.
I can imagine it being something that, you know, teachers would like.
I don't know that they're aiming for that. What they are aiming for are things like the advantages that the Kindle gives over printed textbooks, which include the fact that you can't say, oh, I don't know what that word is. Well, it's got a dictionary built into it. And how is it said? Well, it's got a text-to-speech engine in it that does inflection.
I wouldn't trust the text-to-speech engine on the words, but...
No, actually, for each of those words, when they're doing it, they use a pronunciation guide from the dictionary. They're not doing it just from the letters. It's an identification of the word and then using the phonetic...
I think the dictionary is the best. I mean, when I read books on the iPad a lot, and I often come across words that I don't understand. And in the past, I would just, you know, get the meaning from the sentence and just move on and just assume that I knew what that meant. And but on the iPad, well, I'm sure it's Kindle's the same way, you just kind of tap on the word, it brings up the dictionary definition, and you just instantly know what's really being said. That's like a really valuable service. I don't have to know how to pronounce something, but knowing what something means, that's really valuable.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced on the pronunciation, because certain words have multiple pronunciations depending on their context.
Did you say pronunciation?
Yeah,
I that's one word you should probably pronounce.
Well, in radio,
correctly.
You know, you just breeze over it and
confusion.
Hope no one notices.
You're saying you're not sure that the pronunciation, the algorithmic pronunciation, if you will, would be correct?
Yeah, because a lot of times computers don't know which of the three different words you're using have the same spelling.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
The emphasis is on the wrong syllable. That's what they call it.
I can't do what you just did. I cannot do that.
Well. And names, you know. How do you pronounce the female character in Harry Potter?
I always thought it was, what about
Hermione?
Wait, you're talking about, here are these edge cases where it couldn't work, and you're forgetting about the 99.5% cases where it would work.
It's true. Most words actually have one spelling and one meaning.
Right. That's true, but the most irritating examples of people doing things wrong are when they use words like there, there, and there, and, you know.
That's true.
As a side benefit, though, English departments in general around the country have an issue with regard to they have a lot of books that they want to get through, different novels, different short stories, and they just don't have the budget for all of them.
Right.
E-books in general cost much less than their printed counterparts, which meant that the English department of Clearwater High was able to fulfill their wish list with their
for all
English,
the books.
Yeah,
oh, nice.
For their English curriculum.
You just have to make sure they're available in as e-books.
Right.
So I guess, I mean, it's curious.
Which a lot of canon is. Most things that are like.
If you think of their purchase of the Kindle, of course, is a large expense off the bat. But then if you take a student who's there for, 6 years, is this just high school?
It's just high school, but at the same time,
I was in high school for 6 years.
But each student is given a textbook. Don't forget the textbooks cost money.
That's what I'm saying, is that if you look at the 4 years, the amount of textbooks they won't have to have. Mm-hmm. Now, what about some textbooks that are going to be more useful or more? I guess in a textbook, you're not even supposed to write in it because you're kind of leasing it from the school. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to give it back.
Kindle support highlighting and notes.
That's true. No. I was just thinking the math books might be the difficult ones, right? Because the keyboard's not that effective.
On the contrary, open textbooks have been really surging with regard to things like the sciences, things like math and physics. And so the Kindle, to my knowledge, does support PDFs.
Well, no, I'm not concerned about the format of the reading capability,
like,
but if you
notes.
Want to take notes. Yeah. So when you're dealing with math and you want to take a note, it's not easy to do that in a keyboard, that kind of thing. But then again, you might always have a piece of paper next to the
There's
Kindle
nothing stopping the student from having a pen and paper,
or
a pencil and paper in the case of
I did see a story about a medical school that was giving iPads to all their students. I was going to talk about it a few months ago, and they... they generally liked it, but a lot of them said, well, we can't sell our books back, all this kind of stuff, because the materials were still expensive. But, I mean, you got to assume that when you look at the amount of textbooks out there, the amount of paper being put out there, there's a savings going on here, whether it's resources or money or
everyone
what.
Everyone should be saving a little bit in this scenario, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the idea of selling the book back, you should be able to. If you've purchased an e-book, you should be able to sell it to somebody else. Now, I know that we covered issues where that doesn't happen, but...
In the electronic world, the electronic world does not follow the same rules as the physical world, unfortunately, in our current legal time.
Really? Sorry. good thing it doesn't, too, because we have things to talk about on this show. Thank you very much for that.
That's really interesting. A really quick story I came across is ebooks are only 6% of printed book sales. So I wonder if as schools move towards using ebooks instead of textbooks, like physical textbooks, that's a lot of books, six, 7 books per year per student, plus all the English books.
And Miles' point about the backpacks is a good one.
Well, many textbooks are reused from year to year.
Yeah.
So they're... You can't make a direct analogy there. It is going to be a
Kindle,
case by case.
And the Kindles will not last as long as the textbooks, I'm assuming.
Well, the question is, are we going to be overrun with trees?
That's right.
There's going to be trees everywhere if we do something like this.
All right, thank you very much. Speaking of...
people's backs.
Yeah, that's the backpack thing, definitely. Right. Yeah, the saving. And in fact, a lot of high school students use rollable backpacks. They don't have to carry these things around.
Well, those who use rollable backpacks and me get teased. And people trip their rollable backpacks. So it doesn't work so well. It's a
Ben's
good
memory
idea.
Of high school 2 months ago.
Pretty much
fresh and painful.
Can you imagine students, not too many years looking back and seeing pictures of their parents with backpacks when they're in high school or something like that and going, wait, what is that? That's where my books were.
They didn't have anti-grav units on those?
Why don't you just have a little package?
Your books were? Why? You had like 7 e-readers? I don't understand. Al.
Yes.
What's going on in the design world?
Well, this one I think is kind of geeky. It's a little crossover between a lot of stuff what I do. I do a lot of interface design. And I came across this webpage called darkpatterns.org. And what this site does is, what they say is naming and shaming sites that use black hat anti-usability design patterns. Now, there's a lot of things you can do to a user with the interface that makes them do certain things. You know, as an example... you can put a button at the bottom that click this if you don't want to receive the newsletter or whatever. And it's very small and you don't see it and you're doing it. And then all of a sudden you keep getting all these newsletters and all that kind of stuff.
Well, and then there's a court case and they're like, look, right here. And of course, they've done a print of the page,
right,
which is nice and clear.
Why didn't you check it? We wrote it
right there. It's
but, you can do a lot of this stuff to people.
Doesn't it tick you off when you see the example of that? When you see that checkbox all kind of gray and small, you're like, they made that small so I wouldn't click it.
Yeah, to me, it's interesting because I think, oh, that's how they did, because I'm thinking about these things all the time. But when I went right into this site, it's kind of nice because this site is chronicling and kind of categorizing these types of techniques that are used. There's quite a few of them. Just to name off a few, they have these creative names like Roach Motel, Bait and Switch, which we're familiar with that kind of term, Sneak into Basket, Silent Credit Card Rollover, Hidden Costs. There's a neat one here called... It's how they get your you sign up for something and you give them your Facebook account information because you want to see who else is doing this, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they get that, and then the company then gets all your Facebook information. That they've named that one privacy Zuckering, which I think is a pretty,
yeah, great.
Pretty good
named after the privacy. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
Yes, there's a lot of really neat ones in here. The Roach Motel is one that. Named Roach Motel, and what happens on this particular
what,
kind of situation.
What sites do they reference? Like,
well,
they
for instance, the Roach Motel, LAFitness.com does it. You go in there and you go in and you inadvertently subscribe to the email, but in order to unsubscribe, you've got to send them snail mail. So it's very difficult to there's a path, but it's so difficult to do that it's the Roach Motel. You get in, but it's really hard to get out.
Right.
I mean, there's a way out. You just can't get out.
I was just looking into the sneak into basket, which of course would be like a shopping cart edition.
Yeah,
Travelocity,
you know,
does
who,
that.
Travelocity, exactly. Yeah. Sneak into basket. They will put things in there like, do you want travel? Click here to opt out of travel insurance.
Right. By default, it says yes. I want travel protection plan for 1995. And
right.
That's like the default setting.
And if there's so many things you're going through, you're doing this, you don't see it, and they price it at 1995, where it's at a point where, you know, you just bought something, a ticket, it costs
you
$200.
You're not going to go back the process of trying to remove it. Yeah.
Are you going to go through something for 1995? A lot of people won't. You know, and to do it, it's kind of a real pain, and a lot of times you don't even realize that you did that.
So it's all about design patterns that are creepy and freaky.
Yeah, it's getting these things in, and it's a nice website. I think everybody should go to darkpatterns.org at least once and kind of familiar.
Yeah, before you do any more purchasing online, go there, look through it, and then you'll be more educated on how they trick you.
And be hip to all those little interface tricks that they're so prevalent. I mean, they're literally everywhere. So
I can't stand it when I want to like get something quick, like on Amazon or something. Mm-hmm. And I got to look at that whole page and go, okay, what are they doing to me?
Right. What exactly do I get this gift? Do you want a free gift? You know,
I want
a free gift.
I really appreciate a site has a submit to next button and it says right below that you can still preview before committing.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I love that. You know, because once you don't see that anymore, like, okay, I'm committed if I push that button.
I know.
And you can really review everything.
I know. I really like the fact that the site exists, though, just to kind of educate. Just everybody. Anybody can go here.
And these companies should change this battle, the way they do this, I think.
And when you see ads for win a free iPad or a free iPhone, yeah, nothing's free.
Nothing's free.
You know, okay.
Never try to get anything for free on the internet, ever.
I get that. And yet, my first iPhone I got by spending $19. Of course, I had a lot of other friends spend $19 too.
Yeah, you also had to harass your friends for a month on end.
You never did it, Miles, as I recall.
Yeah, I don't subscribe to harassment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look beautiful, though, so that's okay. All right. I think it's Ben's turn. Hi.
Yeah. Hello. So I would like to tell you guys about a new plane. It's a human-powered ornithopter. So basically...
What is an ornithopter?
An ornithopter is basically a plane which is... Or it's an object which is held aloft by wings. And some definitions say that the wings have to be flapping.
As popularized by
Leonardo da Vinci.
Well, birds have been doing that too.
Oh yeah, that's
birds
true.
Popularized it, and Da Vinci kind of.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true.
Da Vinci showed a
da Vinci
design
was a
for
thief.
One,
yes.
And it was popularized in the novel Dune.
Yeah, that's true. Back in like the 1480s or something, Da Vinci drew up a bunch of sketches. Well, it turns out that after all of this waiting, we finally have one. Not we, but Todd Reichert of the University of Toronto. He's a PhD student for their Institute for Aerospace Studies. And he built the Snowbird. And it is, as I said, the first human-powered ornithopter. It's the first airplane that flaps its wings and stays in the air.
First human-powered
plane.
Yes. That does this. There has been another ornithopter.
That was like 1996 or something. I'm getting my years wrong, but it was like between 5 and 15 years ago, and it was also the first of its kind, and it was machine-powered. And you see you can find all this old video footage of people testing out all these different designs back in like the 1950s and stuff. stuff, and it's just kind of laughable trying, you know, watching these machines try and get into the air, and you're like, oh, that'll never work.
A lot of spectacular crashes to watch.
Yeah, exactly. Tons of awesome crashes.
This'll work.
So how long can you do it before he gets tired out?
Well, yeah, so it's basically pulleys and lines pumped by pedals. It's built out of carbon fiber, foam, and balsa wood. And he kept it aloft in this flight for 19.3 seconds. So it's just a little under 20 seconds. It's not like, oh, yeah, you can go flying for an hour or something like that. And he had to be really buff to do it. Like, he trained his legs. He actually went through a program to train his legs to get them to be strong enough to
propel himself through
air. Himself through air without the aid of the ground.
Yeah, we don't think about it much, but a pigeon taking off from the ground is expending a huge amount of energy relative to it just soaring through the air.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're pretty lightweight, but even still, it is a lot.
A lot of birds have circular breathing too, so they don't really have to go. They're just kind of always breathing, so they get their...
Well, on the exhale, they're able to oxygenate their blood on the exhale in addition to the inhale.
So they're keeping their muscles completely supplied, and then their bones are like feather light. You know, plus they have feathers. Yeah. Their feathers are feather light.
The thing I heard of is that their genome is specifically slim, which is amazing. So normally you get a lot of junk DNA in creatures, and it doesn't really affect much, but it actually makes the cell larger if you have a whole bunch of DNA that's not being used. And birds, anything that flies basically, doesn't have as much junk DNA because it's selective pressures to not have large cells.
All that DNA weighing you down.
Yeah.
Talk about a pressure we'd think of as very small, but it's actually... Not enough over a few million years. Yeah, yeah.
Well, a few million cells.
The other thing is he flew for 145 meters, and this plane has a wingspan of 32 meters. Think about that; it's like 100 feet. It's a huge, huge, huge wingspan on this plane. It's like a Boeing 737 or something like that.
How do you?
It weighs 94 pounds though. The whole plane.
The whole thing.
Like, yeah, it's very light.
I love that. There's some. The Green Mars, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars series. I can't remember who wrote it, but it's a wonderful book series. Maybe we should look it up. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Martians do a lot of flight because the gravity is so much lower. With carbon, wing systems, you could potentially fly.
Yeah,
pretty cool.
There's a program called X-Plane, I believe. It's for the Mac. It's basically this guy decided to write a flight simulator that actually models air and air molecules hitting the wings and, you know, vectors and stuff. And he actually changed it so it's not an Earth flight simulator, but it's a Mars flight simulator. And the only way you can fly is with this, like, I don't know, this plane, this custom plane that's in that you fly on Mars. It's this huge glider, and it has a wingspan of like,
because the low atmosphere pressure,
5,000 feet or something.
Right.
It's like,
and of course,
huge.
The sci-fi I'm talking about, they have an atmosphere on Mars now. So
it's yeah, different. That's true. That's true.
All right,
and you can't turn.
Thank you very much for the human powered flight.
Yeah, and
that.
I'm going to put that up on the show, and I'd really request that anyone who is the least bit interested in this look at this video because it's so beautiful. It actually doesn't look like any of those mechanical, you know, things. That looks very organic, and the wing flexes, and it's really very bird-like. And
it's not the spastic kind of flapping you see in the old movies, you know, it's like this elegant.
It's not like a pigeon taking off or anything. Yeah. It's like, oh, and he needs a car to get it going, but, you know, one step at a time.
What? A car?
Yeah. By the way, he needs a car.
it's pulled by an airplane.
Again, to get it going.
And he needs a forward air pressure, airflow.
He needs an atmosphere.
70 miles an hour.
I mean, what kind of plane is this?
All right, thanks very much for that. So more down to earth, what's going on in the woods of late, Mr. Miles?
In Oregon, Google has a bit of a complaint. One of their networking engineers, Vijay Gill, was telling a conference in Sydney, Australia, that hunters in Oregon shoot down their fiber optic cables from the trees. They're being hosted on poles. And, well, they're hosted on the same poles as the electricity poles.
Right.
And the hunters apparently some of them get bored and try to shoot at the inflators.
Shoot the inflators, yeah.
Yeah, so they can get like little sparks and stuff flying off of it.
It's funny.
Right.
Hey, why is the internet down?
Al can do that because he hunted a lot in high school.
And while this engineer was saying that he has yet to see them actually hit an insulator, they regularly shoot down the fiber optic cable.
And wait, in fact, I don't understand. Shooting the insulator, you mean like the point that actually holds the wire up?
It's a little ceramic ball that's on the things. You know, the little ceramic.
Yeah, the thing that holds it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're standing below the cable, and you're shooting up at it and hoping the cable doesn't fall free and kill you.
You know immediately that they're not the brightest people to do this.
Because they're shooting at electrical lines.
So you got to assume that already.
All right. So but they are taking out the they are taking out the fiber
optics. In fact, they're doing it every year.
Around hunting season.
And someone has to go out there cross-country skiing to try to take it out, because that's when hunting season is during the latter parts of the year.
Just look at your resume. What do you do for a living? Well, hunters take down fiber optics, and I'm the guy that fixes them. How crazy is that? So you have to be proficient in skiing and dodging.
So what Google is planning on doing actually is going through those areas, digging a trench, and burying the fiber optic cable underground as opposed to hoisting them aloft.
All right. That's awesome. Thank you very much for that. So when you're out, I don't do hunting traditionally, but I do camping. And one of the things, of course, is problematic is getting clean water out there. Al, can you help us with that?
Well, I can't help you with the clean water, but I can help you with the clean air.
Missed it by that much.
It turns out that there's a company, it's a German company called Blücher Technologies.
Is that like out of Young Frankenstein? Frau Blücher?
Anyway, they've developed this wallpaper it purifies the air. It's called Ceratec Permazorb Wallpaper. And it's got these little nodules and stuff inside of it.
Is that the technical term? Little nodules and stuff?
They're little. It says embedded with thousands of tiny spherical absorbers. And they look like little tiny balls of carbon or something. And the whole thing, it's filled with thousands of branching passages that sort of resemble the interior of lungs. And the technology absorbs and stores pollutants, which makes it the first air-purifying wallpaper. Put in your house.
How long does it last?
You know, you'd think, they don't say how long it lasts. A lot of these things do last a very long time. They just kind of store the... I don't imagine...
The walls just get thicker and thicker.
Yeah. But
the ribbons of the veins of the stuff kind of expand, and the wall starts to look like it's got
Cell
structure.
And then 200 years later, they tear it down. And
I was just thinking,
exposed.
Think of what wallpaper looks like in a smoker's house over a long period of time.
Yeah.
Now imagine this stuff that's made to absorb
right.
all of that stuff.
Oh, man.
I wonder how long do you keep wallpaper normally? I mean,
maybe
a couple of years,
you know what this stuff is?
Some of us just paint.
Yeah, I know.
Who here has had to paint over wallpaper, though? Oh,
yeah.
Peel it off. Interesting. I think wallpaper has a decade lifespan, right? Because you can always pull the wallpaper and go, oh, this is from the 60s. Like, you know right away what era it is. So it's probably just last 10 years.
They say that it's not perfect enough yet for the mass market.
How do you know what era it is?
What era
it is?
The designs. Wallpaper has very specific designs.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, man, I had a house that was wallpapered in the 70s. Beautiful. Just gorgeous. Big dots of color.
Daisies.
You could actually have a seizure by going into the bathroom. It was incredible. So this breathing, it doesn't breathe. It's just there passively.
It just absorbs, and it just consistently absorbs.
See, all I can imagine is those sponges you get that are all flattened and completely dehydrated, and you put them under the faucet, and they go.
Oh, yeah.
And I can just imagine the wallpaper is going.
Well,
like, how big is this room? Well, when I moved in, it was 10 by 10, but unfortunately we've lost an inch and a half.
You know, you do put things in rooms, though. You know, you install carpet or something. It smells like chemicals for, like... I remember when they built the Logos building, I used to have to go in there because there was a type place in there. I get things...
Typeset?
Yeah, typeset or whatever. And every time I went in that place, they had just put down the carpet, and it's that indoor-outdoor carpet. And I don't know if it was like glue or whatever, but like over a year. I mean, you go in there, come out, and you're like hallucinating.
That's the thing is, wallpaper has a smell to it. So does this stuff not have a smell to it?
Apparently, it doesn't say, but I would imagine it would absorb its own smell. How interesting.
You're in a house and you're like, I want an air freshener.
Yeah.
It's not working.
Yeah, really. Anyway.
Well, thank you very much for that lovely story.
New
air purification.
Yep.
Not something you'd go using hiking. you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. In just a second, I'm going to point to one of the geeks for a geek bit. But first, let me let you know that KUSP co-sponsors the 2010 Alzheimer's Memory Walk, a day of fun and remembrance for families friends and caregivers dealing with Alzheimer's every day. Registration begins at 8:30 a.m. and the walk begins at 10 on Saturday, September 25th. Hey, that's today, as I recall, at the Seascape Resort and Park in Aptos. Information and registration is available at 800-272-3900 or online, 3900, or online at alz.org/memory walk. You're listening to KOSP. This is Geek Speak. Everything we talk about on Geek Speak is up at geekspeak.org when we get around to it, about a half an hour or so after the show. Today, the geeks are Miles Elam, Al Luckow, and Ben Jaffe. And the Geek Bit of the Week?
Could be Terry Pratchett getting knighted.
Please.
Terry Pratchett, the sci-fi author, probably best known for his Discworld series, was knighted by a sword that he himself fashioned.
Cool.
And not only did he fashion it himself, he also threw in a couple of meteorites just for good measure.
For the hilt and stuff?
For the blade itself, for the metal.
That's cool.
You know, highly magical.
How many?
As he says, you've got to check that stuff in whether you believe in it or not.
Was it 42 inches? Or what was the number again? Forget.
I don't remember. Although he says that he can't carry it around. He's annoyed that knights aren't allowed to carry their swords. It would be a knife crime in the UK.
You can't carry knives? Not even unshielded? Or not even shown? Gosh, the UK is so
mean. They have no equivalent of the Second Amendment.
Wow. Because you can do that here. You can carry a sword on your hip anywhere you want. Creepy, huh? All right. Well, thank you very much for that. That's a perfect geek bit. Terry Pratchett, of course, is a sci-fi author of Newt. Let's go on to ask people to call in. You're welcome to give us a call with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800, and we'll take any calls you'd like today about technology, preferably. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. We did get an off-air comment about our crazy, wacky discussions, and the comment was that ebooks, one of the challenges is students with disabilities. Ebooks are not published in accessible format. And that's true. We talk a lot about ebooks, and they're not published. Well, I mean, the thing is, they are.
In an accessible format?
Yeah.
The Kindle is the accessibility device. That is what allows for the text to speech.
And it also enlarges the text.
You can allow the font size a lot larger as well.
So it's, I would say it's less, you can't like say, here you go, here's an object that is, you know, easier for you to use.
Yeah, it is not as readable in full sunlight as a book, though.
It isn't.
Chances are you would have to be I mean, it's an LCD screen. It's not going to be.
Margaret, if you'd like to call back and get on air and talk about the issues around accessibility, we'd love it, because right off the bat, I think Miles and I are thinking, no, it sounds like it'd be pretty accessible, but I'm not familiar with all the accessible the needs for making things accessible. I'm assuming that a e-reader would be equivalent for sight impaired, and then it's got text to speech. But how would you navigate the text to speech on an e-reader? Is there like a couple buttons you can do that? You can turn the whole thing on to eat that, so you can pick the book and everything. Like, that could be a problem, and I don't know.
I know that Amazon has made some, has put a fair amount of effort into it. I don't know how successful they were at it, and I would be curious to hear how successful they were at it.
All right, Mr. Ben Jaffe. What's up with Google?
So Google recently released something that's really, really cool, but it's been an invite-only thing, and I've been waiting for my invite code. It's called App Inventor, and it basically allows you to program applications for your Android device, so that be it a tablet or your phone. And I just got my invite code, and this is really, really, really cool. I mean, before, I didn't really get into app development because, although I know I can if I want to, I don't really have the time to spend to learn a whole new language and a whole new developing environment.
Can I argue that point, or should we let it pass?
You can argue that point.
Do you have a job right now?
Yeah, okay. I do.
Do you have 3 kids?
No.
Okay.
All right. That's a logical fallacy. You have it worse, therefore I can do anything I can.
All right, okay, you don't have the time. Go on.
Anyway,
so why does this help?
So this is really nice because it doesn't actually require you to learn the syntax of a new language or really much of a developing environment. It provides a pretty simple developing environment, basically in a web browser and a Java applet that you download. And and you can develop with it. And as far as all the logic goes, the Java section of this app development kit has a bunch of node. It's kind of a node-based programming system. So instead of calling a function by typing the function name, you click and drag it from a list, right? If you want to do a for loop to repeat some code, then you can just drag that node in. And it a lot of times when, at least when I program, I don't program a tremendous amount like Miles or Lyle. And so a lot of times I'll forget to pass a parameter to a function, and that'll be my issue. And sometimes the debugger doesn't quite give me the information I need to realize that's my error. Whereas this, it's kind of like puzzle pieces graphically. So you can click and drag these different puzzle pieces. They click together, and you can build an application like this. And the really cool thing about this is it's actually easy enough that I tackled it as soon as I got the invite code around noon yesterday. Mm-hmm. And by 2 o'clock, I had a working, I had one of the demos working, and I also had my own working app for texting people, just quick texting people. And it's pretty awesome. It's really neat. So
thanks.
Anyway.
App Inventor.
Is that it on your phone right there?
Yes.
Can you invite us?
No, I cannot invite you. You have to add your name to this Google spreadsheet.
And then wait for a while. All right. Thank you very much for that story. Earlier, Al, you mentioned the design website. What's it called again?
Darkpatterns.org.
Darkpatterns.org. Okay, thank you very much. Let's see. Going on to the next story, let's go ahead and go to Mr. Miles Elam. What's going on for court cases?
What we're finding more and more with court cases is that there is a disconnect with what people perceive as their rights under the law. For example, we expect that our mail will not be opened up by federal authorities or local authorities unless there is a court order. But that doesn't extend to email. It turns out it also doesn't extend to your Facebook posts and your Facebook profile. In New York, there has been a case where the Supreme Court judge of one of the Supreme Court judges of New York was saying that social networking sites are not private lockboxes where you store your most intimate secrets.
Right.
They're considered a public place, even if, for example, you have it set up that only your friends can see that post. It doesn't
matter.
It's
still considered public?
It's still considered a public space, and therefore, quote, plaintiff has no legitimate reasonable expectation of privacy.
Wait a second. So in the mail, this breaks down. Like if I take a piece of physical snail mail, and I write something to you, and it's in a closed envelope, and then I set it into a public space in the sense it goes on the roadways, and the postal clerk delivers it, and it goes into a public government building for sorting, and then goes to you, I can assume complete privacy in that whole scenario, right? But now,
by current laws, yeah.
But now, if I do that digitally, it's not that same?
It is not the same. Also, bear in mind that the postal laws are not protected by the Constitution. That's separate laws that were made to protect the postal service.
That's true.
So there are no special laws protecting, for example, posts to Facebook.
If the Postal Office Department made like a social network and gave those rights to us, then they'd have special. There you go.
Or if lawmakers said, if you have this space online where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, like, for example, if you say, I want this post specifically only be read by this subset of my friends, not even all of your friends, that seems like an effort that says, I don't want this public. I don't want this for public.
The other thing you have to remember, though, is if I tell you, Miles, the secret I have, okay, it's a secret, if I'm telling you some kind of private thing, that's one thing, and you probably won't tell anybody, but if I tell 250 of my Facebook friends and, somebody's going to say something. So anytime you have anything, even if you have a lot of friends, there's always somebody that's going to say something.
Right, you're kind of talking about like if you're speaking to one person individually, you can assume some privacy. If you're speaking to a group of six people, it's almost like speaking to the public.
Right. So as soon as you get beyond a certain amount, I mean, I listened to a thing, I think it was This American Life or something. Some guy did some joke about going crazy in an Apple store.
Right.
He's going to go in there and, do all this stuff. Well, somebody
quoting Fight Club, the movie Fight Club.
Yeah, quoting Fight Club. He says it, and sure enough, the SWAT ends up in his front door. one of his friends said, hey, I think this guy's crazy.
Right. And I kind of get what you're saying. I mean,
right,
the
but
idea,
that's informing from one of the people involved. I mean, to say that if you say this to a group of 6 to 10 people, then
it's equivalent
it should be considered public, means that every boardroom meeting in the world becomes publicly accessible.
Right.
That's ridiculous. Currently not the case.
Yeah, that's just confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is... You are correct that it's hard to keep a secret, but at the same time, it would be like...
It's all about assuming privacy, right? You can assume privacy in certain situations, and at some point you say, well, your assumption of privacy is kind of gone. If you put something in the backyard and the fence is short, you can't assume privacy. Kind of like if you're grouping, talking to a large group, at some point, it's not private.
If I send you a message, or if I send a message that's to be read by 10 people... Let's say that
so
I write a letter
one.
and not an email. I'm talking about a physical letter send out and
carbon
it's sent
copying
to a group
everybody
and everyone sees that. Still, federal officials cannot intercept that mail without a court order,
right?
But they could go to one of the recipients and say,
and
"Show me
it.
A copy of that letter."
Right. Right.
That's what I kind of see it with regard to Facebook. That would be the analogy to me, that they could solicit one of those friends and say, "I want." Can you show that to me? That's
right.
That would be it. But just unilaterally saying we're going to go in through the front door and look at that person's post.
It also, of course, this whole thing is also a side effect of a society where data is so easy to duplicate and copy that it's almost impossible to get rid of it. So once you have that Facebook discussion, like if I sent you a letter and then the letter sits at your home, it's pretty hard for somebody else to get a copy. But when it's on a system, it's in a database, and there's multiple copies already because each person is now cached on their computer for a little while. It becomes a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
Al?
Yeah.
Hi. What's your annoying story?
This is sort of, I guess, kind of related. It's called Recorded Future, which is media analytics. Now, it's at a website called recordedfuture.com. And what this service does is it's sort of a temporal analytics engine. So it scours the web looking for things that are of the nature which you've identified you want to know about. And it ranks and organizes all these stories and things. And then it makes it accessible and useful. So if you wanted to, if you're coming out with a product and you wanted to put that in there and you wanted to sort of get the idea of what everybody was saying about it and all that kind of stuff, it's really good for that kind of stuff. But it also helps you understand relationships between firms and other products and events that are happening. And then what it does is it predicts what's going to happen in the future. Now, when you go to this site, there is a free service that you can go in and you can type a few things in, and it'll give you reports. It seems to stop after a while because I tried it and it just kind of stopped. But I guess you have to renew it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's. If it's kind of pricey to get the full service, but the full service gets you all these things, all these graphics. It pulls in patents and all this stuff. So if you're a business and you're trying to predict what's going to happen
in your area,
say you deal with like webcams or something, mm-hmm. and it just says, oh well, these guys applied for a webcam, this patent, and it's a 3D thing, and all these guys over here have a wireless thing, and all these things come in, and then they sort of have this little prediction scale about what's going to happen next.
It's interesting because it's kind of like the you hear. Every once in a while, Apple just released a new patent on touchable portable devices. So they're going to have like a touch phone.
Right.
Right. And of course, that happened. But that idea, normally an analyst does a lot of, you see these big firms that do a lot of this analysis. You're saying that some of this can be automated right off the bat.
It's automated by this. It'll do things like it'll say, oh, these guys just formed a partnership. So there's these two companies, and this one deals with webcams, and this one deals with webcams, and they just formed this alliance,
Right, and one of them has this kind of patent, and the other one has this kind of patent.
Right,
and,
it's basically recording it's called Recorded Future, but it's actually predicting the future based on, this scouring the web. It's just a very advanced type of thing. It almost feels like the kind of thing that Google will buy eventually.
Right. Yeah, it does feel that way. It's fun to spot companies like that. Oh, cool, we'll buy that. They're doing a good job.
Yeah.
We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. You can ask us anything you'd like. We'd be able to answer it. 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Now that I'm thinking about that user interface thing quite a bit, Al, and when I said you can ask us anything you like, I'm not putting in the subtext, we might not know the answer to it. But you can technically ask us anything, like, as long as it's not inappropriate for air, because we won't let you do that. But please do call us up and ask us anything you'd like about technology.
Yes, you also said we can answer anything.
We
but
can.
You never said that we'll answer it correctly.
That's right. Thank you.
Yeah, there we go.
That's
very right. Clever. I thought of that. As soon as you
saw
that
subtext.
Thought,
bait and switch.
476-2800 again. That's 476-2800. 1-800-655-5877. I believe next we're going to be talking about particle physics. Ben?
Yeah. So we've talked about the LHC before. That's the Large Hadron Collider. It's the largest particle accelerator ever, at least on Earth. And it's also, a lot of people have said, this is the biggest and most complicated thing we've ever built.
The
more
most complicated ever.
Than Photoshop or Windows.
Impossible. Wait, no. More complicated or more complicated to use? I bet it's easier to use than Photoshop and Windows.
I don't know. Maybe it's more consistent in its in the results it gives you than,
all right,
say,
the LHC,
Windows.
So what's anyways, the story?
So yeah, we've talked about a lot about this this particle accelerator and all the things that they're doing with it. But a question popped up maybe a couple years ago, actually, was when I first saw it. What would happen if you put your hand in the beam?
Uh-huh.
And
in the beam
never
of the LHC?
In the beam of the LHC, the beam of all of the particles that are speeding at 99.9999, I think I have the right number of nines, percent of the speed of light. What would happen if you put your hand in the beam? And I didn't really see an answer pop up for all this long time, this very long time. But on the Bad Astronomy blog, there was actually a post and a video. Some people asked a bunch of scientists about this, and they don't know. Like, that's the answer is,
why don't they know?
Well, I haven't really thought about this, but like, how could you work on a project like this and not think, what happens if I put my hand in there? you know, it's just human nature,
yeah,
or something.
It is.
Of course, the first problem you'd have is that the particles are all going around in this big loop at, you know, almost the speed of light, and they're in a vacuum tube. So the first thing would be you'd have to get your hand inside of this very skinny vacuum tube somehow.
Okay.
Who knows how that would happen? Anyway, assuming you could do that, assuming you could just put your hand in there, what would happen? And the answer is they don't know. Some statistics I came across is each particle is 7 trillion electron volts. So if you were to apply that same amount of energy to a mosquito, it would be a mosquito in normal flight. But imagine all of that energy of a mosquito, you know, bonking up against your hand, condensed in an area a million times smaller. That's pretty much what we're talking about.
Right.
And then the entire beam itself has the energy of an aircraft carrier moving at about 11 knots. So a lot of energy. But all of the confusion is, you know, would it be possible for the entire beam to dump all of its energy into your hand?
No,
right?
Rip it apart. But also, when the targets that they hit, aren't they normally very dense materials like leads and things, so that they actually, most of the particles hit? I mean, you a lot of these particles are just going to go right through you. I mean,
that's true. Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you actually look at your hand, it seems very solid. But if you look at it very, very, very small, you've got the nucleus and you've got the electrons and you've got all this empty space that comprises the atom,
yeah.
Right? And so really your hand is a lot of empty space. It's not
dense
material.
But still, I mean, they vacuum, they remove all the air from this thing, so there's not extra collisions, right? Because all the extra collisions is going to cause a lot of heat. So mm-hmm. You put your hand in there and suck up the vacuum, you're still got a lot of tissue there. I mean,
it's kind of like, so Phil Plait on the Bad Astronomy blog said, what if you shoot a bullet at a piece of metal, you're going to make a hole. What if you shoot a bullet at a fishing net, like a wide fishing net, like your hand, for example? It's a lot of material, but tons of empty space in between the material. What happens? Does it go through your hand? Does it hit your hand? Does it hit? You just make a little hole in your hand?
We need a sound effect on Geekspeak that's like down the tech rabbit hole, because we've just gone into ridiculousness.
Yeah,
exactly. All right.
Yeah, maybe I'll write an Android app for that, and I can plug my phone in.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. Let's see if that happens. Well, let's just start taking calls from Santa Cruz. Stephen hung up.
Hello, dial tone.
Oh, we did lose Stephen. Darn, I was hoping to speak to Stephen. Well, let's go ahead and, Miles, you want to tell us real quick what IP version 6 is, or IPv6?
We talked about it previously on the show. It's a, right now, it's better to talk about what people are used to right now, which is IP version 4. when it's an IP address, people are all fairly familiar with that. It's a string of four numbers.
With dots
sometimes,
in between?
Yeah, with periods in between. That's what you'll put. Sometimes you'll see in your web browser, it'll be these four octets is what they're called, followed by the rest of the web address. And a problem with that is that it's limited to only a few billion addresses.
And we've run out.
And we are running out rapidly. And trying to recycle and trying to do stopgap measures around it. And IPv6 is a way around that. One of the ways that one of the problems it fixes is a 128-bit set as opposed to a 32-bit set.
So a lot larger number.
A lot larger number to the effect of you can give
every hair follicle on the planet an IP address.
Every grain of sand on every beach, I think a million addresses, something
yeah,
like
that's
that.
A lot.
It's a ridiculous number.
It should take us well into the space age, that's for sure. All right, and so it's still coming along and it's still not really being adapted completely.
It already exists.
Yeah.
If you've bought an Apple product in the last 3-4 years, you have IPv6 enabled and probably is working in your house right now. Without you having to do anything.
Right.
Windows 7, I know, supports it. Vista, I believe, also had support. XP was a little shaky, but... The big limitation is ISPs don't support it as much, although
right.
I know that Comcast at least was doing some pilot programs not too
sure.
long ago.
And you mentioned on air. Thank you very much for that. Other updates, just to mention, everything we talk about on GeekSpeak does go up on the GeekSpeak website. It normally goes up about a half an hour after the show is aired live, and that's pretty much when the podcast goes up too. So the things we mentioned today that seem to be of interest, one of them is how you sign up for this app creation tool, the Google app creation tool, Ben. And Ben will have that link up there, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Great. Well, let's go ahead and take one call from, well, I'm not sure. I guess Salinas. David, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello, David. Are you with us?
I am with you.
Great. What's from Salinas. What's your question?
My question is, I've got a Mac about two and a half years old, OS X, with VMware installed.
Right.
Now, my understanding is that's kind of a clone that runs Windows programs. Is that correct?
It can run any operating system. That's correct. It's called VM stands for virtual machine.
Okay. Are there any tricks to it? I get on it sometimes, but it's I don't know. It's not real responsive, and I'm having a real hard time printing. And I've even gone. I can do files. I can manipulate files. I can get on the internet and so on. But the printing function. Is there any particular tricks or anything, or is it?
I use VMware, and printing is really a real bear on VMware. VMware
okay,
for those people out there who don't really understand what this is, it is a virtual machine, but that you can install on Macs. And Macs have an Intel processor, so they could run Windows. The other thing, though, you have to remember is you have to buy Windows. You can't just, VMware is an application. It's an environment. Okay, then you have to buy Windows and then install that onto
right.
VMware. Or you install, I guess, Linux or whatever the heck you want to run on that, sort of PC-based.
And printer sharing is difficult because you have to tell which operating system can control the printer. You have to basically assign the USB port to Windows install. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it, and the way that I suggest, is sharing your printer on your Mac and then using printer sharing on the Windows
to
see it.
Yep, you could do that.
A little weird, but...
It's difficult because sometimes, I sometimes try to use a webcam over VMware, and it won't let me use it. You basically have to sort of kill the processes that are running on the Mac side of
right.
it, and then have them going on the Windows side. Like, especially if you have USB things. If it's a USB printer, then you run into, like...
Parallels does this pretty well. You kind of see all the USB peripherals attached in Parallels, and you say, I want to assign this to Windows, and
right.
it removes it from
that's
the Mac
what you,
environment.
You know,
I think VMware does the same.
It
models.
Does it along the bottom. Yeah,
yeah.
It does. It does have that.
I have a quick question for you, David. Are you running XP in that virtual machine? Or Windows 7?
I'm trying to remember. I loaded my wife's... Windows 2000 Office XP, I think.
Okay.
The older unit, she's got a new computer with the new Windows, but I have not loaded that.
Okay. The long and the short of it is I think that Lyle's advice is good, that you share it from your Mac and read it from your PC, but with XP, it's probably a good idea to get the printer sharing download that you can get from Apple.com. It allows you to be able to see the printer from Windows without going through a whole lot of extra hoops.
Right. Thank you, David, for the call. We're going to go on. Thank you so much for the call. You can, of course, ask us questions and comments by sending email to geeks@geekspeak.org. Our website doesn't have emailing support, I just realized. So you have to send email to geeks@geekspeak.org. Some geek should probably fix that. In just a moment, we're going to do the wonderful, crazy USB of the week live and in person. That's right. I want to let you know that you're listening to GeekSpeak on Central Coast Public Radio at KUSP. The geeks today are Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe and Al Luckow. Of course, my name's Lyle Troxell. Answering the phones, as he is every week, is Rick Philman. And Rick, we really appreciate you being here to siphon through what we do. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Sunday evening at 9, it's KUSP's poetry show. Host Dennis Morton interviews and reads poetry with guest poets. On this week's poetry show, listeners will have a chance to call in for one of the 5 subscriptions to Poetry Magazine. That's KUSP's poetry show Sunday evening at 9, right here on KUSP. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. And Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. All the stuff we talk about on the show and the podcast as well, if you'd like to listen to it again, is up at geekspeak.org. Mr. Al Luckow, what's going on in the crazy USB of the world?
Yeah, well, you know, this one was sent in to me by a listener, Chuck Byers, who he's on the East Coast somewhere. I sent him a shirt, by the way. He just happened to be an extra large, which is
what we have left.
Advantageous for you if you want a shirt.
If you want a shirt, be an extra large or an extra extra large.
That's all we have. Yeah. Anyhow, this thing is called the My Coffee Cup Speaker for iPod, iPhone, and MP3 player. You know, as soon as you start seeing the titles of these things have really bad grammar, you know right away something is kind of tricky. This thing, it's basically a paper coffee cup. And the speaker is in the plastic top. It looks exactly like it has a little brown sheath that goes around it.
Like a Starbucks cup of coffee.
Just like a Starbucks cup of coffee. And the speaker is in the plastic portion on the top that you clip onto the top. And then it has a plug into the top of the plastic thing. Now, the only way that you can charge this thing is through USB, which is silly in a way. Well, the whole thing is silly. I mean, this really fits into, like, what would you do? Go to a coffee shop and then kick this paper cup out and then clip this top on that's actually a speaker. That,
and then plug it into what?
And then your iPod or your iPhone or MP3 player. It literally, I can't imagine a situation where I would want to do this. And it's made out of real paper, so it's not like it's like some long-lasting thing. I don't really understand.
Does the cup have the battery? Or does the top have the battery?
The top has the battery.
So everything's in the top.
Everything's in the top.
So you reuse this top on every cup of coffee you have.
Well, it comes with a cup, and you know,
but
given
you might not use that
given
cup.
The nature of this type of thing, I would think it only fits on one cup, their cup. But I just can't imagine a situation where you might want to use this thing. It's just really,
well, you know,
really
I gotta
silly.
Say, that just sounds crazy.
It does say iPod not included.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yes, nothing like truth in advertising. It's got a 2-watt amplifier, 2 audio jacks, 1 inside and 1 outside. So that means you could put your iPod inside the coffee cup.
It's a disguise.
It's
for
a disguise.
Your iPod.
Okay, that's what
I wonder. Where's like, that music coming from?
That coffee cup's amazing. It has a USB port.
I'll take one of those.
No, it can't be that guy. He just has a coffee cup. That's all.
Yeah, but very, very weird. It's got a 3.5 millimeter audio cable, and it actually comes with a manual. I don't really know what.
Don't drink the iPod.
Do not pour coffee into this cup while iPod is in cup.
And where can they learn more about this?
You can learn more about this on geekspeak.org. I got the posting up there. Thanks to listener Chuck Byers. And if you have any crazy USB ideas, feel free to send them in, geeks@geekspeak.org.
And to all of you for listening, thank you so much. Geeks, thank you very much for being here. It's fun as always. Coming up next is Car Talk for KUSP and GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.